Well, first, my father was a sailor, which is where I get my mouth from. And so obviously you're moving around a lot in a military sense. And then he became a priest, and you can sort of, go back and forth to different dioceses.
Okay, hold up
Oh, yeah,
there.
that's a little bit. Okay. All right, bring it, bring it.
Yeah, so someone going from sailor to priest, that's not
It's
a
not
thing
a
you hear a
typical
lot.
route. No, it's not.
That's a little snippet from a conversation I had with Patricia Lockwood a couple years ago. As you can hear, that detail from her life, that her dad, who was a sailor, became a Catholic priest, kind of intrigued me. Well, now Patricia's written a memoir called Priest Daddy. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to talk to the poet about that book and some other things too. Patricia, good morning.
Good morning, Gina. It's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you too. Well, last time we talked, you lived in Lawrence. I hear you've moved.
I did. We moved back to Savannah, which is where we lived before we moved back in with my parents,
We being
subject,
you and your
obviously.
husband.
Exactly.
Well, when did you decide to write this memoir?
I would say that I decided to write it when I was literally in the upstairs of my father's rectory, probably hearing him shred some prog rock on one of his guitars, thinking to myself, how am I going to stay sane in this environment? Well, I better write a book about it. So I'd say that was a maybe a month or two after I moved in there a couple years ago.
What was it about being back in the environment that made you wonder if you could preserve your sanity?
Well, I mean, imagine going back to your childhood home. How would you feel if you moved back in with your parents in your early 30s?
Okay, good
It's not
point.
exactly, yeah, it's not a situation that's conducive to sanity, in my experience.
A lot of people probably think of memoirs as writing about yourself, but your memoir has a real focus on your dad, not just his transformation from a sailor to a priest, but his sort of charismatic personality, which is seemingly full of contradictions, which you play with a lot in your writing.
Yeah.
Can you talk about those contradictions, about this personality that, I mean, your father is obviously someone very close to you, but he seems to be even a mystery to you.
Oh yes, he's a mystery to everyone in the world. And I don't know why I didn't call him a seaman. It would be a better thing to call him than a sailor. But yes, so he's obviously a guy who is an extremely larger than life personality. And when you grow up kind of with a larger than life personality in your household, it really does affect you. And I think that as a kid, you spend a lot of time sort of like thinking about the personality and why it works the way it does and how it affects you. And I don't think that you quite have the tools when you're a kid to understand it as well as you do when you're an adult. So when I returned, excuse me, to my parents' house, that was really an opportunity for me to sort of like untangle this extremely conservative guy who at the same time is constantly wearing tiny underpants and, like I said, playing the electric guitar.
The beginning of your book, Priest Daddy, is really artfully written. I feel like I'm sitting at a kitchen table with you and your family talking about the past, which is probably because that is exactly how the book starts.
That is how I open, exactly.
Could you read that opening scene for us?
Absolutely. Before they allowed your father to be a priest, my mother tells me, they made me take the psychopath test. A priest can't have a psychopath wife. It would bring disgrace. She sets a brimming teacup in front of me and yells, "Hot!" She sets a second one in front of my husband, Jason, and yells, "Don't touch it!" She situates herself in the chair at the head of the table and gazes at the two of us with total maternal happiness, ready to tell the story of the time someone dared to question her mental health. We are congregating in the dining room of my father's rectory in Kansas City, where I have returned to live with my parents after 12 long years away. Jason presses his shoulder against mine for reassurance and tries to avoid making eye contact with a graphic crucifix on the opposite wall, whose nouns are like a poem's nouns: blood, bone, skin. We are penniless and we are exhausted, and in the grand human tradition, we have thrown ourselves on the mercy of the church, which exists for me on this earth in an unusually patriarchal form. It walks, it cusses, it calls me bit. It is currently shredding its guitar upstairs, across the hallway from the room where we will be staying for the foreseeable future. Through the east window, I can see the same dark geometry of buildings that surrounded me all throughout my childhood. Closed school, locked gymnasium, the squares and spires of a place of worship plummeting up into the night. Well, you wouldn't want to bring disgrace to the Catholic Church, Jason says, with a diplomacy that is almost beautiful, making a great show of blowing on his murderously hot tea. No, you wouldn't, my mother agrees. They came to the house because where people are a psychopath the most is in their own homes. And they tried to trap me. They brought all these questions. They said, oh, did you ever feel bad when you killed someone? Which drug tastes the best to you? When your dog talks, what does he say? How many times have you been suicidal? They didn't believe me that I'd never been suicidal. Why would I be suicidal? I'm in love with life. She bangs down her rosebud-patterned cup with unexpected force, seized with a sudden urge to backflip through time and attempt a citizen's arrest. They were using so many double negatives that finally I just lost it. You can come back here and give me that test when the questions are in English, I said, and I chased them away. I don't understand how you passed, I say. From what you're telling me, it sounds like you should have gotten a pretty bad grade. It sounds like you should have gotten the worst grade, actually. I passed it by being smarter than the test itself, she says, lifting an aha finger and touching the tip of my nose with it. Same way I got the highest ever score in the history of the SAT. I didn't even know you took the SAT. The Sears Aptitude Test, she clarifies in ringing tones. They had never seen anything like it. Why would you hang that on your wall, Jason breathes, staring past us at the bloody spectacle of the crucifix, held spellbound by its gore. Why would you hang that in the room where you eat? It looks like someone screamed into a ribeye. They also tested you, my mother continues, to see if you were a psychopath. But you were young enough that nothing showed up, thank God. Your dad gets an F, Jason says, looking up the questions on his phone and motioning us to be quiet. Listen, I was a problem child, true or false. I am neither shy nor self-conscious. I speak with authority, true or false. I am not or would not be proud of getting away with crimes, true or false. I can hear my father's objections now. Who wouldn't be proud of getting away with crimes? Who wasn't a problem child? When your dog talks, doesn't he tell you that you're a champion? Mom can't remember if he took it at all, but if he did, Jesus must have appeared at the last minute and filled out the answers for him, because he was allowed to walk through the doors of the priesthood freely, as upright as sanity itself, while his sane wife and sane children watched sanely from the pews. Jason continues to scroll through the test, growing more and more horrified as he goes. When he reads, I often get others to pay for things for me, true or false, he clutches at his heart. We're psychopaths, he says mournfully. We're being psychopaths right now, in your dad's holy rectory. I told you it happens at home, says my mother.
So that's Patricia Lockwood reading from her book, Priest Daddy, her memoir.
Priest Daddy.
Yeah, about the year she spent at home with her father and mother, but her father being a priest. So tell us the story of your dad going from atheist sailor to Catholic priest. It's still surprising to me that a married man with children can become a Catholic priest.
Yeah, and people always have questions when you tell them that. They're like, oh, did he have to divorce your mom? Did he have to, like, disown his kids? No, I mean, it was all above board. It was on the up and up. But basically, so he started out, you know, as like a teenage rock and roll atheist, and then he joined the Navy after high school. And when he was down on his patrols, he and the rest of the sailors obsessively watched The Exorcist as their fun time, you know, like Saturday night movie. I think they watched it like just dozens and dozens of times over the course of their first patrol. And I think it freaked him out a little bit. And he converted to Christianity, you know, in the depths of the sea, basically, and called up my mom and said, you know, I'm a Christian now. And my mom's like, well, I told you so, because, of course, she had been a Catholic the whole time. And so he came back on land, and he sort of studied to be a Lutheran minister because he had decided that that's what he was going to do. And of course, Lutheran ministers can be married. And then after he was a Lutheran minister for a little while, he's like, no, it's not extreme enough. I'm going to be a Catholic. And when that happens and the minister is already married, you can get a special dispensation from Rome and become a married Catholic priest. It's just a super rare situation.
You just have to pass the psychopath test.
You have to pass the psychopath test. And again, I was like, Dad, how on earth did you even pass that? I go into this later in that chapter, and he's like, well, you know, the first time I answered every single question wrong because the test pissed me off, and it came back that I was a complete psychopath. And they were like, what are you doing? And so I had to take it again, and then it was fine.
So he passed on the second try.
On the second try, yeah. So he got two tries. So maybe they give you a little bit of leeway.
How old were you?
I wonder about that.
How old were you when this was all happening?
I was little. I was like maybe 5 or 6. I had been a Lutheran for a while. I was baptized Lutheran. But I don't remember my test at all. My mom said they came to the house. They talked to us to make sure, you know, everything was okay. And apparently we passed the sniff test and we were fine. So we did not like impede his priesthood.
It seems to me that taking the time to write a book about all of this is, in part, has to be like an effort to understand a really important part of your own life and your own background. Why do you think it's so important to you to understand this particular story?
Well, you can't really run away from it. You know, if you've been raised in a really extreme environment, I would say, like I was, you might go through a little period after you leave the house where you just kind of ignore it. You don't think about it that much. But it really was such a huge formative part of my life. You know, Catholic thinking in particular really like formed the way I thought and the way I formed my arguments, you know, all sorts of things like my sense of aesthetics, my sense of beauty, all these sorts of things. So I had to at some point come to terms both with Catholicism and with my father's incarnation of it. So you can't, you know, keep your back turned to those things. And when you find yourself in a position where you're going back home, I mean, that's as good a time to deal with it as any.
What was it that brought you back home?
We had a health crisis. My husband developed a rare form of cataracts, and he had to have his lenses replaced. We had to actually raise the money online because, you know, how many people just have $10,000 sitting around, you know, waiting for an emergency like that. And afterwards, we were just sort of broke. And my mom said, you know, well, you can always come back and we'll support you as long as you need. So we took advantage of that. And we were there for about 8 months.
What were some things that maybe your memory hadn't retained about your family and the environment? You referred to it as an extreme environment. And
yeah.
What was it that you noticed about that environment that was extreme that maybe had seemed at least a little less extreme when you were immersed in it and hadn't known some other life?
The first thing I noticed was how freaking loud it was. Okay. I can't even explain to you. It's like the wall of sound. So you walk in the house and there's sound coming from a couple of different sources. There's usually like a Michael Bay movie playing top volume. Then there's the electric guitar sound. Then there's some sort of conservative talk radio coming from another source. There's no point any sort of like a peaceful haven of rest or any sort of like mad testosteronic sound. It's just shooting their gun constantly.
You know, it seems to me like there's a part of you in your writing of the book Priest Daddy that finds a kinship between you and him, whether it's what the two of you look like as babies or something a little bit more personality oriented. But is understanding the complexity of your dad just, is that crucial for you in understanding you?
Well, I mean, I think that's something you're going to deal with when you're writing a memoir that is centered on your parents. I mean, I talk a lot about my mom as well. But yeah, I do think that I have a lot in common with my father. And I also think that a lot of elements of my personality were formed in reaction to him. I think that that's true of any person. You know, we don't just spring fully formed out of people's skulls. You know, we come from a place, we come from people. And I don't think that you're being honest in a memoir if you don't look at your source and see what you might in fact have in common with it.
Well, the book is pretty funny in a lot of ways, but there's definitely sadness in it too. I'm not all the way through it yet, I need to acknowledge, but there is a scene.
You're fast. How far did you get?
I got a few chapters in. But there's a scene where you find out the night before you're supposed to leave for college that, in fact, you are not going to be able to head to college after all. And it's really heartbreaking. Can you tell us that story?
It was actually like 2 weeks before I was supposed to go. It was the night before Christmas, which was so sad because Christmas is truly my favorite holiday. But yeah, I was all set to go to St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland. But there had been kind of a strange atmosphere surrounding the preparations. We hadn't really gotten any supplies. You know, we hadn't had any sort of talks about like when we would be driving up. I had never visited any of that sort of thing. So maybe I was in denial about it. But yeah, the night before Christmas, my father called me into his study where he was blasting Rush Limbaugh and simultaneously watching Bill O'Reilly and I think also possibly reading the Drudge Report on his computer. So all three things going on at the same time. And he sat me down and he said, you know, well, we just can't do it. The money's not there. And I always sort of accepted everything that my father told me at face value. You know, a lot of people would say, like, why not investigate? Why not, like, look at all these different routes for financial aid? And why not, you know, stand up to him or see why? Like, why can't I go? But I just took it at face value and just sort of said, you know, okay. Like, of course I won't be going. You know, why would I ever think that I could go to college, even though that had been my dream? But yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, when you grow up with a sort of authoritative presence, not just authoritative because he's your dad, but because he's like a figure of an institution, a sort of figurehead, I think that you don't always figure out that you can argue with those people or that you have any latitude to change what they're telling you, to change your own destiny. So that was really something I had to learn.
There's also, I mean, it's a very sweet story, but there's some sadness to it too, just in the setting. In your teenage relationship with your future husband, who you meet on the internet and talk
on the internet.
Yes. And you talk late at night on the phone in a deserted convent. And
yeah,
there are aspects of that story that I think anyone can relate to, the late night phone conversations.
Sure.
At the beginning of a romance, especially a teen romance. But the setting being this deserted convent is unusual.
Yeah, that's unusual.
Can you tell the story of that relationship and how it started?
It is a pretty funny, you know, it doesn't sound funny at all now because now everyone meets on the internet. I don't even know like how people are meeting for, you know, relationships in ways that are not the internet now. But in the past, it was really freaking weird. But yes, so I was living obviously in the sexiest form of house, which is an abandoned convent, which was next to my father's church.
And this was instead of going to college.
This was instead of going to college. I'm living in an abandoned convent next to my father's church. I think maybe working at Chili's at that point, if you want to add on another depressing layer. So I'm working at Chili's by day. And at night, you know, I log onto the internet, get into a sweet ass chat room, you know, and talk poetry with my bros, because that's just what you do at that time. And it was actually, I think it was a bulletin board that we met on that was devoted to the discussion of poetry. So, you know, there had been this dude and I, and we had been talking about obviously the thing that we were most interested in, which is literature and, you know, it's in the writing of it and the reading of it. And it just grew into something more. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no. I mean, what was your relationship with the internet? I mean, in terms of trying to, at this particular age, have a world that grows, even though you don't end up leaving home as you expected.
Right.
That provides you an education, even though you're not going to college as expected.
Right. I mean, it might be hard to imagine right now when the internet is just like an absolute trash heap full of fake news. But at that point, it was my only access point to the world of information, pretty much. You know, I felt that I could go there and just find out anything I needed to know. And most of what I was finding out was, you know, how little I knew about anything. thing. But it seemed like there was just this enormous sense of possibility, this like enlarging sense that you were standing at the doorway of something, that things were within your reach, you know. So at the same time, as you're falling in love, like with that sense of possibility, of course, you know, you might be falling in love with a human being as well. So it, those two things were very tied up together for me, you know, this sense that maybe I could escape, maybe I could get out into the real world of things that were true and things that were beautiful. And that maybe also there was this person that I associated with those true and beautiful things who was going to be my partner.
And he did. I mean, he's your husband and...
Yes. We've been married a billion years.
What, when you finally did leave home, did anything, did your imagination of what life beyond the rectory would be like, did it conflict at all with what things turned out to be like, or was it kind of as you had hoped and imagined and dreamed?
Not for a long time, but there was a period after getting out of my house, which again had been ruled by Catholic theology, by sort of like very conservative information, where I think that I just had to reorient myself to what people thought in a broader sense out in the world, that not everyone was thinking about the Eucharist and the Pope all the time, you know, just that you were allowed to think about other things and do frivolous sorts of pursuits. So in that sense, yeah, the possibilities didn't disappoint me whatsoever. And I felt that I was participating in the world. But at the same time, with a lack of education and sort of with like very limited financial resources, you really did feel, or I felt as a person who was attempting to be a writer, like I didn't see any way that that was going to happen. It seemed like that was going to be a very difficult road for me to walk. And it ended up being hard. Yeah.
You know, part of what was interesting to me about this whole scenario, I mean, this is a really bizarre detail that I've latched onto, but you write about when you come home and start living with your parents again, having had a life where you ate salad.
Yes. Well, it's not that we never ate salad, you know, in my parents' house. It's just that it was mostly pork products. Yeah.
That's so you do come home and it's for health and financial reasons. And in a sermon, your dad refers to you as the prodigal daughter, and you're there in the pews listening to this. Did coming home make you feel anything like the Bible's prodigal son, or was it a comparison that in some ways just didn't fit for you?
No, I mean, it's almost a perfect parallel. I lived with the pigs, you know, and then I came home and they killed the fatted steer or whatever. It was a perfect parallel. No, it's just funny. That particular scene in the book where I'm listening to my dad tell a sermon about me is just always strange. I mean, it's strange when people write about you. It's strange when you hear their opinions of you. It's even stranger, I think, when you hear that sort of thing from the pulpit and there's an entire congregation listening along with you, you know?
Yeah. Well, so I want to get back to your relationship, not just with the internet as this source of knowledge for you, but with technology and note-taking. You've just written a piece about that for The New Yorker. Talk to me about, you know, growing up with your sailor dad, then Lutheran priest dad, then Catholic priest dad, taking notes. What was the evolution of your note-taking?
Well, I don't think that I ever kept a regular journal like a normal person. I never had a diary. I think that my diary would have been kind of depressing. But I did like to keep a notebook with me, and I like to write down, you know, individual lines of poetry or things that struck my fancy. I like to write down quotes and things of that nature, just sort of stray thoughts. So I always kept more of a commonplace book. But I also had sort of an issue when I was a kid that, you know, I would like... I had kind of an obsessive compulsive personality. And if I made mistakes in my notebook, I would like rip out the pages and I would cross things out. And it was a source of anxiety for me, basically, you know, that I couldn't keep this perfect, pristine notebook with no mistakes in it. So the piece for The New Yorker was a little bit about how I discovered note-taking apps and how freeing that was, because you can't really make a mistake in, you know, on a smartphone. You can do whatever you want.
So you were talking about that as a kid, you had this obsessive compulsive part of your personality. Is that gone, or has the technology...
No, that's still there. But the technology has really helped me deal with that aspect of it. I don't, you know, have that nagging sense that like there's a limited resource of pages, that it comes to an end at a certain point. You know, I can do anything I want in there. I can insert pictures, I can put any sort of quotes, you know, I can write down an idea.
You can fix a mistake.
You can fix a mistake, yeah. And if I want to add on to something later, if I want to change it, it's not any sort of problem at all. So for a person like me, that was a huge lifesaver.
There's a note-taking file that you've been keeping, I don't know for how long, I'm curious about that. It's called Do This, Do That. Can you tell us about
Yes.
Do This, Do That?
Do This, Do That. Yes, I've been keeping it for a couple years now. It's sort of like a practical spell book. And I use it to collect all sorts of quotes from people who do creative things or, you know, physical, athletic things, musical things. You get a lot of good ones from singers, that sort of thing, where they sort of talk about their art, but they do it in such a way that is sort of like a Zen cone type thing. So like if I open it up just at random, I have a quote from Clarice Lispector that says, "So writing is the method of using the word as bait, the word fishing for whatever is not word." So if I'm reading a book and I come upon a quote like that and I think, well, that says something useful to me about the writing process, then I put it in that file.
What is the useful thing that Clarice Lispector quote told you?
It tells me something about the way she thinks about her work. So she has another one that I've put right next to it that says, "The facts are sonorous, but between the facts there's a whispering. It's the whispering that astounds me." So she's basically talking about what she does with text and what she's trying to reach for with it, which is the ineffable. And so if I come across something like that, I think, you know, that speaks to me, I put it into the notebook.
How does this notebook serve you? I mean, do you remember what's in it and that there's something there that you want to go back and get word for word? Or when you're struggling, do you just return to it?
I return to it. I like to think about the different ways that people do things. And I like to especially hear that from people who are in different fields than I'm in. I think it's really like sort of illuminating about creativity. So I sort of, you know, separate them into different chapters, and then I write little like meditations on creativity at the end of them. But they come from the most surprising sort of places. Wikipedia is an excellent source. Paris Review interviews, you know, you just find them everywhere.
Is there an example? You said you like to get these tips from people in different fields. Is there an example of a non-writer or even a non-artist of any kind who has a piece of wisdom for you coming from a surprising place?
Yes, absolutely. One of my favorite ones is from the director of a movie called Man in the Moon. His name is Robert Mulligan, and he directed Reese Witherspoon in this movie very early on in her career. And I just love this quote. He says, "When I saw Reese's test, she just jumped off the screen, simply as a personality. I couldn't tell whether she could act or not, but she's got a wonderful face, and there's a brightness and intelligence there. Then, when I tested her in Santa Monica, a strange breakthrough took place. Early in the movie, Danny is a bit of a tomboy. Reese was trying to project this in a scene where she had to get angry with the boy, but it had a false ring to it. Because in real life, she isn't a tomboy. She's a girl's girl. Just before we did another rehearsal, I told her I wanted her to chew gum. Well, she started chewing gum, and all of a sudden the performance happened. She was tough, strong, direct. And the scene worked, like that. In an instant, it was there. What was marvelous was, at the end of the scene, Reese knew that something happened. Her compass, her sense of what's real, kicked in. The motor was running, and she knew it. It was funny because she said, 'Can I always chew gum?' And I said, yeah."
How do you use that quote as a poet?
Because I think it gets the sense that sometimes a small detail can unlock something for you. And it can happen in just a really magical, intuitive way. So you can be going along and you're just like staring at a brick wall and you don't understand how you're going to get something done. And then something as small as, "Can I chew gum?" comes along. And it unlocks the whole thing for you.
Patricia Lockwood, formerly of Lawrence, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck with your new book, Priest Daddy.
Thank you, Gina.
Thank you. When we return, a Kansas City poet slips back and forth across the border of language, Spanish and English. That's next on KCUR's Central Standard. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Now we're joined by poet Gustavo Ibar. And he lives here in Kansas City, where he writes in Spanish and in English, in some ways a translator of his own poetry. Hi, Gustavo.
Good morning.
Tell me about yourself, about your background, and what brought you to Kansas City.
Oh, man, that's such a really long and boring story.
Not boring.
I'm originally from the Dominican Republic. I was born there, but we moved around a lot when I was young. We lived in New York, Los Angeles, and Miami Beach. And while I was enjoying the beautiful waters, yet struggling financially, I spoke with a cousin who was living here and working at the Ford plant in Clay Como. So that's what essentially brought me here, was to try to find work at the plant, which never happened.
You became a poet instead.
Yeah, well, I think I used to always write. I started writing at 16. So I just always continued that.
What changed when you came to Kansas City? I mean, what did you end up doing instead of working at the Ford plant?
Man, I worked everywhere. Work was so much easier to find when I moved here. So I worked at Home Depot and Wendy's, maybe Burger King, and a whole bunch of other places. And I was going to school at the time. I struggled to get back to my academics, but eventually went on to get my bachelor's in English and Spanish, and then my master's. So,
you talked about that you were writing poetry from the time you were really young. How did you get into poetry?
My mother always walked around quoting and reciting verses and lines and different things. And I also have one of my favorite uncles. He was, the oral tradition is really popular and still alive in Latin American culture. And so he used to memorize poems and recite them. And so a lot of the music that he listened to, which I didn't know then, but I learned during my studies, were songs that were actually came from poetry. So like writers like García Lorca, I don't know the title in English, but the Verde que te quiero verde, and just a lot of different songs that I grew up listening to were because of him and the connection to poetry. So it was, I think it was just, I don't know, I enjoyed it.
You mentioned your mom, but it seems like you write about fathers and sons a lot.
I do. It's, you know, I hope she doesn't hear this, because she's, my birth father was never present. And so she was pretty vocal about the fact that kids are really ungrateful and that we're going to turn around and still love him more than we love her in spite of all the sacrifices that she made. She's horribly sarcastic. I think if I can think of my mom, I remember like the film Juno. It was that type of film. It was like morbid and dark humor. And so that's a lot of what I write about in terms of the struggle that I have internally, just to try to understand men and myself as a son and then now a new father. And so I feel comfortable with my relationship with my mother, which is why I don't have to grapple with it in my own writing.
I see. So the writing about fathers is, I mean, you are a father yourself, but it's not that you're identifying more strongly with your father. It's that you're wrestling more with.
I would say so. Yes.
Can you read a poem from your most recent collection? It's the collection is called Between Line Breaks, and the poem I want you to read is Attention Oak Street Residents.
Yes. Attention Oak Street Residents. At our new apartment, rented to create space for the baby, a bulletin board sign reads, African American male, 6 feet tall, mid-20s, with cornrows. Call the police. Standing 3 inches taller, of equal complexion and age range, I wear the gray hoodie required of every jumpstart volunteer. He has been seen in a black hooded sweatshirt or gray puffy jacket. Erica thinks it funny. It remains our joke for days. When will I turn myself in? I think I was at the library, my Don Quixote class, or tutoring. I hope the cornrows Karen will style for me today will be different. I worry while crumpling the paper if our baby were also bear the burden of my dark skin.
That poem starts and ends with your baby, although that is mostly not what it seems to be about, but it jumps, that detail jumps out at me. Can you talk about your approach to writing about fatherhood, which often the poems seem to be about something else, whether it's baseball or a flyer posted in your neighborhood?
It's, you know, I think, I don't know if there is essentially an approach. I know that a lot of what I've been dealing with is just, my son is 6.5, and so obviously that's at least 7 years of pregnancy and trying to be present for him, and not to mention the past years of the absence and trying to deal with that just as a man. I had a stepfather who wasn't as present as I would have liked, but he's the man I call my father, and he was definitely a great role model, and there was love there, but he's no longer here. But for me, I think of situations, I think about my life, and then I try to, I don't know, I feel like there's always this connection that I see in terms of how it relates to me as a man, as a person, and what it is that I'm thinking about on a day-to-day. So I think it's obvious that fatherhood has been one of the obsessions that I've had. And so, like this one specifically, it was during pregnancy, we had just moved in, and the gray hoodie that I was wearing was part of the volunteer work that I was doing. So I constantly wore it. I'm always cold. I have sweaters on during the summer. And it was just weird for me that right when we first moved into this location, I saw this flyer, and I just saw myself reflected in the concern and the caution.
And you're suddenly not the welcomed new neighbor. You're suddenly an intruder in some ways in your own new neighborhood.
Yeah, and you know, and I try not to think of it from this perspective of race, and as always, like pulling out the race card, and here I am, there's another. I didn't think of it as it was me, but I didn't know how else to connect it. I know that as new tenants, you're walking around, seeing the property several times. I think that area, we saw like 2 or 3 different apartments just within like 2 buildings worth. So I don't know. It just feels weird to not sort of say this is exactly what it is.
What, you know, translation is also a part of your art. Tell me about that.
You know, when I first moved here, when I first started writing, I was writing in Spanish. So I was living in Miami. I was heavily immersed in my culture, the food, the people, the music, and just all these people that I knew and grew up with and loved and still do. And so I didn't have to struggle to either think or speak the language. And when I moved here, that was no longer the case. Granted, Kansas City has a pretty big, large Latino community, but I was no longer a part of that because I had other pursuits.
Do you sometimes wish that you were more connected to it?
I believe in a lot of ways I've gained more connection than before when I made the choice. Because what I did was when I was writing in Spanish and I didn't have that community, I felt like I had to make a choice to write in English. And so a lot of what I do now is mostly English. And the translation work comes with me not essentially translating more of my own work, but other authors who I love. And one specifically from Mexico who is... her name is Glafira Jarocha, but she's just been extremely inspirational in helping me develop and find my own voice as a writer.
So you haven't, it sounds like you've emphasized writing in English for a while now. Do you still reach for Spanish sometimes?
I do. And a lot of my work, I try to make sure that I incorporate my culture and just a lot of those thoughts, however they come. So sometimes they actually do come in Spanish, and I try to keep that in its original sense. And with some of the projects that I have moving forward, my goal is to definitely write a lot more in Spanish.
When KCOR Central Standard returns, we'll hear a little bit more from Gustavo Ibar about Spanish versus English in his poetry. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here with local poet Gustavo Aybar. He writes in two languages, Spanish and English. He's been writing mostly in English lately, but he was just telling us that going forward, it's going to be more of a concerted effort to be reaching for Spanish. What do you reach for kind of conceptually, Gustavo, when you reach for Spanish?
That's such a tough, I don't even know I can answer that. I know that there's something that frustrates me when I read bilingual works, and there's always a translation that follows the foreign language.
In italics.
In italics, yes, exactly. And so I know that when I read whatever and they say hola, because I understand it, I don't need to read hello next to it. And it really aggravates me. And so a lot of what I look towards is not wanting to translate whatever phrase or statement I just made. And I took a workshop a while back where the author said, if you're going to use a foreign language, then make sure that you at least provide enough description or explanation of what was missed for your non-Spanish speakers. And so that, I think, freed me to be able to write sentences and whole paragraphs within my own work. Now, I don't have that within these other collections. It's more personal stuff. But the next collection that I'm working on, there's going to be a lot of references to my country, my culture, my music.
Puerto Rico.
Dominican Republic.
Dominican Republic, it's okay. Excuse me.
There's a lot of Dominicans there. So there's a lot of that. And what I want is to be able to keep that as original as possible. So if people get it, great. If they don't, I'll try to figure out how to help them.
You know, do you think of poetry as something that's meant to be read aloud or read on a page? Because when you talk about how things appear on a page, that's only part of poetry. Part of it is the sounds. And I would think that sounds would be the hardest thing to translate, the sound of a poem.
No, that's true. There's so many different elements to a work. And as a translator, I know that there's a lot that we have to compromise on. And sometimes the way that we want to say something, it may not capture it in its original context. So we have to make a sacrifice and say, well, I'm focusing more on sound for X reason, or I'm focusing more on meter or line length. And I definitely believe that sound is extremely important. And definitely when I write, I have my voice recorder, I'll speak the poems into it. And when I do a lot of my editing, it's while I'm getting dressed or driving. And so I'm listening to the work 10, 15, however many times on my drive or while I get dressed. And that's how I'm able to listen to what is not working in the poem.
And so you're a translator too, right?
Yes.
Can you talk to me about when you translate, do you translate only meaning, or is sound part of what you have to translate?
No, sound is part of what you have to translate. And, you know, there's one line that I still struggle with one of the works. And it's basically, it was a rhyme, and it was so extremely condensed. It was short, and it was more or less like a colloquialism or whatever the word is. And so there's nothing that's equivalent to that in English. And so if there is, it didn't capture the rhyme scheme and the actual meaning behind what it was. And so I struggled to try to find a way to keep that same one. And I know one of the tips that I was told or that I was taught is that you look at the jokes, or you look at the rhymes, or you look at whatever it is, and so you think about it in terms of the page. So if this page has three jokes and you just lost one, then try to find, in your translation, try to place a joke somewhere else. So in terms, there's a term called transcreation. So you're not just translating verbatim or translating for meaning, you're also trying to create, you're also having to create something new to your work because there's the language is not as proficient to get the actual point across.
I want you to read another one of your poems. This one, because I think it gets at some of the importance of sound and the music of poetry. And then I want to talk to you about, I don't know if this is one that you've translated, but I want to find out if you've tried and how you would even approach it. The poem is Upon Him Asking Why I'm Resisting.
I have not tried to translate that one.
I can understand why.
It'd be fun. Let's see what page. Okay. I'm getting to the page.
He's turning pages. Turning pages.
Okay, got it. We did an exhibit for the Nelson Atkins, and the painting that I was assigned to create a poem for was Mark Greenwald's painting, Why Not Say What Happened, which was two men and a woman in the bed, and I immediately thought 60s, and this was the story that I came up with. Upon him asking why I'm resisting. Flashing a scarlet glance, I tell him that I am a hawthorn love, planted with a 60s seed, which bloomed and blossomed from a 60s need. What the hell does that mean, he says, directing his cackle and attention towards his books. I was at Woodstock, for Christ's sakes. I heard Joni, Joan Baez, and Jimmy. I skinny dipped and danced and dropped acid. I smoked reefer, marched, and refused to burn my bras because though breasts bound, my spirit and my love were wild. Because though breasts bound, my spirit and my love were wild. Until he caged me in, lured me in slowly with his revolutionary smile, tie-dyed in stories and rhythms. And I reveled and rebelled against his colors, coming alive in song. But oh, darling, his songs were more than music and lyrics. So we hit the road and hitchhiked, lived in communal camps and organized, protested, plus watched pigeons feed, and he kept secrets in every corner of his smile. Yet he wanted me to be one of those loyal, anguished women who waited out crusades or wars and wrote me two letters before his body arrived. 100 million songs replayed in my head that night. Now they come twisted and bright in flashbacks which return me to the wildness at my core. No more laughter sputtering through walls. No more slow walks, sandwiches and beer or concerts on the grass. No more tunneling down basements, shuttered windows or locked doors. No more army ants following orders of forced enlistments. No more thoughts of winding up leather-faced lovers. No more wood smoke and dust. No more diamonds and rust. No more fine-spun fingers pricking at the crease of my pants. No more bullets whistling past our brothers' heads. No more peace. No more love. No more peace. No more love. There's no peace. There's no love. There's no music when we touch.
So with the no more peace, no more love, there's no peace, there's no love, obviously that gets its music from repetition. And you can replicate that in another language, I would think. But how would you replicate, I mean, no more wood smoke and dust, no more diamonds and rust. That's almost impossible to translate.
That'd be really hard. I know diamonds, I think I remember Diamonds and Rust was the Joan Baez album. So that would have to stay as is in English, right? To keep the title as is. But then I like just listening to it and thinking about your comment, there's a lot of alliteration within the work and a lot of rhyme within the work. So that would be extremely challenging.
You'd have to preserve that.
I'd have to. I think you presented a challenge today.
Well, I can't. Good. Consider the challenge issued and consider yourself welcome back to share the results when you've done it.
That's wonderful. I'm going to work on this.
Our time is up. Gustavo Ibar, it's been great meeting you today.
Thank you. Likewise.
You can listen back to any of this morning's conversations with writers from our area, both poets, Gustavo Ibar and Patricia Lockwood, later today on kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, another Troost revival and Latino artists using humor to comment on politics and race. Join those discussions tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Andrea Tudhope, Jen Chen, and Suzanne Hogan. Our interns are Aaron Pelish and Raven Brooks. I'm Gina Kaufman. You can talk to us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST, and I'm at Gina KCUR. Can't wait to talk to you tomorrow, but for now, stick around for Up to Date, hosted by Steve Kraske, coming right up.